Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Jewish Policy Center webinar with guest Lawrence J. Haas of the American Foreign Policy Council. I am Shoshana Bryant, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. We're going to do a quick introduction to the JPC and a somewhat longer introduction of our speaker, and then turn the floor over to him. The Jewish Policy Center was founded in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by scholars and commentators. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits somewhat to the right of center, we are advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. We are in our third year of webinar programs. I never thought we'd be doing this long, but it is one of the good things that has come out of the pandemic. And we have brought you some outstanding speakers, Richard Goldberg on Iran sanctions, award-winning journalist Claudia Rosette on the Hong Kong uprising, and then again on human rights in China, or the lack of human rights in China, Stephen Blank on Ukraine's war and Russia, Jonathan Shanzer on the Gaza war, IDF General Asaf Orion on U.S.-Israel security relationship and the changes in both countries based on their relations with China, scholar of Islam Harold Rode on Turkey's determination to enhance the Islamic nature of Jerusalem. We've brought you Yulia Shapiro, Douglas Fife, Michael Duran, Arsen Ostrovsky, and more. You can find them all and many other things on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. That's Jewish Policy Center, all one word, .org. Today, we're going off on a slightly different tangent. We are not looking at them, whoever they are. We are going to look at us. It should be no surprise to you that America is divided and increasingly nasty. This is a difficult time at home and abroad. We get it. But we haven't always been this way with each other. And I thought we could use a reminder of the relationships between Republicans and Democrats in Washington that carried us through some of the most difficult times of our national existence, and that would be World War II and the post-war period. And Lawrence Haas is exactly the guy to do that. Larry is a former White House official, both communications director for the White House and working in the Office of Management and Budget. He's also an award-winning journalist and presently senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the American Foreign Policy Council. He writes widely on foreign affairs, is quoted often in newspapers and magazines, and appears frequently on TV and radio. Larry writes a column on foreign affairs that appears in a variety of outlets. Over the years, he has appeared in all of America's major newspapers. Pick one, he's been there. And he's written articles on foreign affairs in the Journal of International Security Affairs, Demokratia, and in the JPC's own In Focus. Another reason for me to say, go to the JPC website, check us out, jewishpolicycenter.org. Larry has appeared on all of the news outlets you think he would, and he currently appears every Tuesday night as a commentator on CTV. He's been a guest lecturer at the Government Affairs Institute and the Legislative Studies Institute, and has spoken at Ivy League universities, as well as Montgomery College here in Maryland, spreading the wealth of his knowledge in a very egalitarian fashion. You don't have to pay Ivy League prices to learn from Larry Haas. He has also testified before Congress. Now, my favorite part of Larry's bio is that he is the author of 6 books, including The Kennedys and the World, How Jack, Bobby, and Ted Remade America's Empire. This one was released in March of 2021. It was great pandemic reading. His most recent book before that is the one that matters to us today, which is Harry and Arthur, Truman, Vandenberg, and the Partnership that Created the Free World, which the Wall Street Journal named one of its top 10 nonfiction books of that year. And I will tell you, if you haven't read it yet, it's now out in paperback. I had the opportunity to review both of those books for In Focus Quarterly, and I encourage you to go to our website, look up In Focus, read the reviews, but then read the books. These are a great contribution to your understanding of who we are and how we work. And now, Larry Haas, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Shoshana, for that very generous introduction. Thanks to the Jewish Policy Center for having me, and thanks to all of you for being on. Harry Truman once said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't know." And what he was trying to say is that human nature doesn't change, and that problems repeat themselves, such as the problem of greed and power leading to conflict and war. So if you know the past, you can anticipate the future. But history is important for at least another reason, and that is that if you know the past, you can put the present in context. You can understand that our challenges are not unique, and we've overcome them at earlier times. Today, because all too many of us don't understand history, we think that our global challenges are bigger than ever, our partisanship is worse than ever, and neither of those is remotely true. The late 1940s give us an important window on today, and it should give us some hope. So let's take a look. On the morning of April 12, 1945, Harry Truman was Vice President of the United States, Arthur Vandenberg, the top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And with President Roosevelt's death later that day in Warm Springs, Georgia, Truman and Vandenberg inherited a world in great turmoil. In Europe, World War II was ending, but the fighting had devastated the continent. 40 million were dead. Millions more were uprooted, including many lost or orphaned children. Europe's infrastructure was flattened and its economy was barely functioning. More than half of the housing in its major cities was rubble. Hundreds of ships, thousands of bridges, and tens of thousands of miles of rail were destroyed. Many farms were barren, and as a result, many Europeans were starving, and most Europeans were consuming just half to two-thirds of their pre-war calories. And while the Soviets were technically still one of our allies, they were quickly turning into a dangerous new adversary of the West. Joseph Stalin was breaking all of the promises he had made to Roosevelt to allow free elections in Eastern Europe. Now, with Europe in such a dire condition, the situation was ripe for the Soviets to march across Europe, the Mediterranean, and beyond, or to mount communist insurrections within Western Europe. So who would step into this global vacuum to maintain order? At the time, America stood uniquely tall. Its mainland was untouched by war, and its economy had completely recovered from the Great Depression and was now overwhelmingly dominating the world economy. But for 150 years, America had practiced a homegrown isolationism. It was largely guided by George Washington's warning in his farewell address of 1796 to steer clear of permanent alliances. After World War I, America had once again turned inward, rejecting membership in the League of Nations, largely disarming and erecting new trade barriers. As late as 1940 and even 1941, America was largely isolationist, which greatly limited Roosevelt's efforts to help Great Britain as it fought to hold on against Nazi Germany. Now, with World War II ending, our leaders face strong public pressure to, as they put it, bring the boys home as soon as possible. The wives of soldiers sent letters to Congress, often with baby pictures and even baby shoes stuffed inside. And influential columnists like Drew Pearson were arguing strongly that America's resources were better spent here in the United States. So there was nothing inevitable about America's decision to assume global leadership and to create and lead the free world. It was Truman and Vandenberg who made this happen. So what did they do? Well, from the spring of 1945 to the summer of 1949, Truman and Vandenberg worked together to create a revolutionary new American foreign policy. And with it, America assumed global leadership for the first time on a sustained basis to protect our friends, confront our enemies, and promote freedom. Their bipartisan foreign policy had four elements. Under their leadership, the United States first spearheaded the birth of the United Nations, to replace the ineffective League of Nations. Second, pledge through the Truman Doctrine to defend freedom from communist threat virtually anywhere in the world. Third, rescued Western Europe's economy through the Marshall Plan. And fourth, committed through the North Atlantic Treaty, which created NATO, to defend Western Europe if the Soviets attacked. This revolutionary new American foreign policy transformed America from a reluctant global presence to a self-confident leader, from a nation that traditionally turned inward after war to one that stayed engaged to shape the post-war world, and from a nation with no real military establishment to speak of to one that today spends more on defense than the next 10 or so nations combined. And Truman and Vandenberg overcame great obstacles to do it. They worked together in bipartisan fashion at a bitterly partisan time. These were years of reckless demagoguery that laid the groundwork for the McCarthyism of a few years later. In the elections of 1946 and 1948, Republicans and Democrats attacked one another in vicious personal language that far exceeds what is considered acceptable today. And I do mean that, even today. Republicans questioned not just the judgment of Democrats, but their patriotism. Republican National Committee Chairman Carol Reese called the congressional elections in 1946 a fight basically between communism and republicanism. And Truman compared his 1948 Republican opponent, Thomas Dewey, a middle-of-the-road New York governor, to Adolf Hitler, and said he was a tool of fascist elements within the Republican Party. Now, of course, Truman and Vandenberg couldn't remove themselves from the politics of the day, even if they had wanted to. When they weren't running for office, each naturally did whatever he could to help his party election time. But on foreign policy, this Democratic president and this Republican senator never lost sight of the big picture. They never sidestepped the monumental challenge of Soviet aggression and the awesome role that only America could assume. They never forgot that to reach their goals, they needed each other. So who were these men? Well, they were born, interestingly enough, just 47 days apart in the spring of 1884, Truman in Lamar, Missouri, and Vandenberg in Grand Rapids, Michigan. As products of the great Midwest, they both grew up with a strong sense of Midwestern values, of right and wrong and honesty and integrity that later shaped their views on foreign affairs. But for all their similarities in how they grew up, they were very different in personality and style as adults. So let me give you a few examples. Truman was modest about himself. When he would receive an honor of some sort, he would often write in letters or his diary, "Ain't that somepin', somepin', S-O-M-P-I-N, ain't that somepin'." Vandenberg, on the other hand, was vain and pompous, and he required constant stroking to keep him happy. When Senator Robert Taft asked his wife, Martha, to butter up Vandenberg at a dinner, she later said, "I tried manfully, but he had buttered himself so thoroughly that I really couldn't find a single ungreased spot." And of course, they were different in plenty of other ways. Truman hated the self-important. Vandenberg, as I've just demonstrated, ironically was self-important. Truman was insecure as a public speaker, and he favored short, simple, straightforward language. Vandenberg, on the other hand, loved public speaking. He loved flowery language and poetic phrases. He wrote his speeches over and over again on his manual typewriter with a cigar dangling from his lips, and they became must-see events in the Senate. And finally, Truman was mean and crass and vengeful, and he had a long memory for insults and criticism. Vandenberg, on the other hand, was gracious and forgiving. So how did two such different men work together to such great effect? This Democratic president and this Republican senator succeeded on such a grand scale because first, they shared a vision for what America must do at a very perilous time. They saw that America must shed its isolationism for good, grab global leadership, rebuild Europe's economy, and lead the fight against the Soviets. Second, Vandenberg enjoyed a national stature as his party's undisputed leader on foreign policy that any senator today would envy. And with that stature, he exerted enormous influence over his Republican colleagues. And third, and most of all, Truman and Vandenberg would not let the differences in personality and style or the politics around them threaten the job at hand. If Vandenberg needed stroking before he would cooperate, Truman provided it. If Truman became mean and petty, Vandenberg would save the day with his grace. If the two men needed to communicate privately during times when their parties were fighting, they did so. So what can we take from this and other history? Well, I think there are some lessons. First, and they're quite relevant to today, first, partisanship is not an all or nothing proposition. In the 1940s, as I've demonstrated with regard to the partisanship and the fierce language, politics was an even meaner business than it was today. And on domestic policy in the late 1940s, while Truman and Vandenberg were creating a new foreign policy, the parties fought bitterly over every aspect of domestic policy, the budget, taxes, housing, labor, and everything else. The same could be true today. The parties obviously have major differences over domestic affairs, but there's a possibility of coming together, as I'm going to explain, over foreign policy. Second, I should tell you that there is more bipartisanship these days, and there always is more bipartisanship, even during bitterly partisan times, than people realize. There's great attention on the top tier issues, and people lose sight of what's happening at the second tier. So let me give you just a few examples. There is competitiveness legislation that has overwhelmingly passed both chambers in strong bipartisan fashion and will likely become law. This is to strengthen America's ability to compete with the Chinese overseas, whether it's on manufacturing or other things. It's potentially very important. There is a Prevent Pandemics Act, which pretty much explains itself, prevent and prepare for future pandemics. That just was passed out of the Senate Help Committee on a bipartisan 20-2 vote and has a good chance of becoming law this year. Postal reform passed in a bipartisan fashion, both chambers, and if Biden hasn't signed it yet, he's about to. And of course, there's the effort to change the rules and clarify the certifying of presidential elections, an effort that Joe Manchin and Susan Collins are leading in the Senate and also could well become law this year. And that is really just a very small sample of what is going on sort of below the first level. Third, I should say that personal relations are often overemphasized in Washington. I think for the most part, they don't drive policy. I've already explained how Truman and Vandenberg were very different people. We had read and heard many things about how Joe Biden had great relations on the Hill. He was going to charm Mitch McConnell. They were going to get great things done, move through the partisanship on top tier issues. It mostly has not happened, and I'm not terribly surprised by it. Nobody came in with a reputation for smooth talking and strong relations across partisan lines than the first President Bush. And when he first got into office, he invited virtually every member of Congress down to the White House to tour the private rooms, to jump on the Lincoln bed and all the rest. By 1992, as his poll numbers were sinking, not only Democrats, but Republicans were running from him. There are larger things that drive policy than personal relations. Fourth, I should say that foreign policy through our history, and not surprisingly, is a more unifying force than domestic policy. And I think it's for quite obvious reasons. As Jack Kennedy said, domestic policy can hurt you. Foreign policy can kill you. So it's not surprising that we see, great unity when we are threatened from abroad, whether that's Pearl Harbor, the Cuban Missile Crisis, 9/11, or a whole variety of other incidents. And then fifth and finally, I think frame of reference. matters a great deal when it comes to the making of foreign policy. If you came of age in the late 1940s, when Truman and Vandenberg were doing their thing, you were part of the Munich generation. That was your frame of reference. The main lesson you learned is that you don't appease dictators like Adolf Hitler. And if you do appease them, it leads to bigger problems in the future. If you came of age in the 1970s, you might have had a frame of reference that I will say was Saigon. It was the end of the Vietnam War. The last helicopter leaving South Vietnam with people literally hanging on, you know, the bars at the bottom of the helicopter because they wanted so badly to get out of Vietnam before the North fully took over. And you probably took from that a lesson of American overreach, a lesson of quagmire, and a lesson of perhaps we shouldn't go to war so quickly. If you came to age in the early 2000s, your frame of reference might be Iraq, where even for all the differences with Vietnam, you may very well have taken away the same lesson as Vietnam. American overreach, American problems, America causing chaos and mayhem, and all the rest. I am greatly oversimplifying, of course, what happened in all of these situations. But there's a point here, which is that today, it is possible that the frame of reference for those coming of age is Ukraine. And maybe the lessons that we will learn will be a much different one. I mean, think about what we have seen over the last month. We have seen broad bipartisan support, not just in the United States, but across Western Europe for the sanctions. Crippling sanctions, some of which I believe were strengthened today or yesterday in the NATO meeting, against Russia for its invasion. We have seen the United States and its allies providing increasingly strong weapons to the Ukrainians to fight against the Russians. And we have seen, with great public support, I would submit to you, a restoration of U.S. leadership of the Western alliance, of the free world. And that could prove quite consequential. I do believe that that is reinforced by a growing recognition, not just that we face a world of rising authoritarianism, not just that China is probably our major long-term challenge and adversary, but also the increasingly close relations between China and Russia. And I think there is great recognition and kind of a relearning of what's at stake overseas, the value of American leadership, and what is going on overseas that we better get some better answers to. And with that, I think I will thank you for listening, and I look forward to questions.
Thank you, Larry. That was, it's great to refocus. I mean, what you really did is refocus us on our own history and where we've been and maybe where we're going. So we have a bunch of questions, and I will take one from a listener right now who asks, why aren't the bills that are bipartisan publicized more by the leaders of both parties? Is there a purpose by the Dems and Republicans to keep the animosity and divisiveness front and center?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. Those who are working on the bipartisan bills are doing their best to publicize them. Having said that, there are two reasons why they don't break through. There was an old expression in journalism, which was, if it bleeds, it leads, which is, you know, conflict and the bloodier the better tends to be what reporters and columnists and others in the media want to focus on. And that's been going on for scores of years. And I don't expect that to end anytime soon. And yes, sometimes each party does find the need to underplay the bipartisanship, because after all, when they go home in increasingly gerrymandered House districts and increasingly divided red versus blue states, you don't get much applause for saying, I have worked with the other side on three significant pieces of legislation. You get much more applause by saying, I held firm against those mean and bitter and un-American so-and-sos on the other side. So yeah, it's a quite unfortunate thing, but yes, politically, sometimes they do underplay their accomplishments for with the goal of picking up seats in the next midterm or presidential election.
So this goes along with another question in our pot. If the progressive left has information dominance through academia, through Hollywood, through corporate executives and news media, can genuine bipartisanship with policy give and take actually take root? And it goes with the other question, is the country really as divided as we think it is, or is that clickbait?
You know, I think the second part of that is a terrific question. Let me take them both. Obviously, to the extent that you have groupthink, and I do take the point that in the leading media on the supposed news pages, starting with the New York Times, you do have progressive groupthink. I don't think on the news pages of some of the other papers it's quite as bad, but there is no question that the average reporter is more left of center than right of center, and that does affect news coverage. I am not one, however, who believes that somehow liberals or progressives cannot do not succeed on talk radio as they've tried to do and haven't succeeded because somehow conservatives control the airwaves, they control, you know, all of corporate America, and they don't give progressives a chance. Nor do I believe that because there is this groupthink on the left that obviously has great influence in academia and the news media and, you know, other organs, that somehow conservative voices are stifled. I think that both sides get their stuff out there, and I need not tell you how they do so. Now, having said that, the second piece of this, which was, yes, do we have more bipartisanship than we think? Absolutely, absolutely. I think both parties are missing an enormous opportunity. It's as if they both don't want to govern. I think that both parties, that there is a core moderate governing majority of 60-ish percent in America that believes on the same basic things. They don't want the government in the bedroom. They want fiscal responsibility. They do want a strong defense, or at least strong enough. And you know what else? They want common sense. Now, I don't want to, you know, go too far on this because I could take up the rest of our time here. They don't want political correctness. They want, so on the left, I'm criticizing. They want attention to facts. So on the right, I'm criticizing. But I do believe to this question, and this is really important, there is a governing, I'm convinced there's a governing majority that neither side, for political reasons, can find its way to seize.
So there's a wonderful piece of video that lives. You said there are larger things that drive policy than personality. You were talking about Danberg's personality, Truman's personality. But there was a wonderful piece of video of Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill, and Howard Baker mm-hmm. at the theater sitting together in hysterics over some comedian doing something. I don't remember what he was doing. But doesn't it seem that images like this help to reinforce the concept that you can talk about issues, you can talk about policies, and you can disagree on those policies, but it doesn't have to turn into the kind of nasty and backbiting scenes that we have today? How do we get back to there? Could Joe Biden go to the theater with Mitch McConnell? I don't know. I'm not suggesting they do that. But I think Reagan and O'Neill were making a larger point that for all the disagreements they had, which were intense, they were still doing the same thing for the same people.
Well, I think that's right. Look, I don't underplay the important symbolism of that. And guess what? Speaking of bitter enemies, how about Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich not just working together in the cabinet room and the Roosevelt room of the White House, but sharing a stage and debating their different visions of government? So absolutely, I think that's important. You know, I'm reminded that there was this incident during the Obama years in which Obama made a big deal about inviting John Boehner, the House Speaker at the time, to golf, and they golfed together. And then there was a lot of commentary, well, that really didn't do anything. You know what? This is this has to be a sincere process. It has to be one of those things where, like, you know, I'm gonna get to know this guy. And we're gonna be honest with one another. Now, will it eliminate the disagreements? No, but it will provide, to your question, at least more of a sense that it's okay to meet together, even if we disagree. It's okay to try to find a path to get to yes on what we can get to yes on, while, you know, setting aside the things where the answer is still no. So I do believe your question's an important one, and your point's well taken, and I don't want to overstate the point that I was making. I just don't think it's the driving force, but can it help? Absolutely.
Thank you. So a listener suggests that bipartisan agreement might have to follow rather than precede one side or the other building a solid electoral majority for its views, and then others could come along. Making the point that the last couple of presidential elections have been very narrowly decided. And this was even before the cancel culture and, you know, a lot of this stuff that goes on online. So is it possible that we are actually more divided, that somewhere we have to get the policies out there before we can get the bipartisanship to follow it?
I don't know. It's a tough question. Certainly, you know, when Ronald Reagan won 60% of the vote in 1984, the Democrats did feel somewhat compelled to work with him on some stuff. You'll remember famously that, at least some of us will remember famously, that Richard Nixon won about 60% of the vote in 72, and actually, even before then, was doing a lot of cooperating with Democrats on domestic policy while they were fighting over Vietnam, interestingly enough. So I, you know, this chicken and egg question, I don't know. Let me give you a counter argument to the question, okay, or at least the implication. So Joe Biden wins election in 2020. With apologies to anyone who's left of center on this, who's listening to us right now, I think he made a fundamental mistake, which was the country voted, in my opinion, for a return to normalcy. It was no surprise that Biden won the nomination, because Democrats are more moderate across the country than they are in Washington, and certainly than they are in AOC's district in Brooklyn. And the country, as I've said previously, is more moderate. I do believe that if Joe Biden had taken an incremental step towards restoring normalcy and had addressed, you know, the economic problems that we were still suffering from, I think he'd be in a lot better shape. I think his fundamental mistake was to try to do what the left calls transformative change. I don't think anybody voted for transformative change. That's why Build Back Better isn't going anywhere. And that, I would submit to you, is a large part of his problem. So I think he missed a great opportunity.
Yeah, I wonder if he could get another opportunity, perhaps in a foreign policy issue, to get it right the second time. I agree that he could have done better the first time.
I think he's getting it right on Ukraine, Shoshana. I really do.
I was going to go there. Ukraine, also the rise of China.
Yes.
How we feel about Russia. You know, those are all areas where I think there might have been more division. Not Ukraine. We didn't really think about Ukraine. Mm-hmm. until the war. But China and Russia, as rising powers, as concerns for us for the future, I think the war in Ukraine has sort of solidified people's view about what the U.S. has to do. So maybe he gets a second chance. Maybe he gets a chance to bring some guys to the White House, talk to them about where he's going, talk to the country about where we're going. Maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is an opportunity. And what I think is great about this opportunity, however horrific the war is, of course, is that it's a reminder to an older generation, and it's a teaching moment to a younger generation. No one is going to defend freedom if the United States steps away. We were waiting in the wings when the British stepped away in the late 1940s, okay? No one is waiting in the wings. I think people are understanding that. I think people are getting a reminder or a tutorial that only the United States can rally the allies. You can't, in the famous phrase of President Obama, America cannot and should not lead from behind. We should lead from the front. And I would say, thirdly, to your point about China and Russia, I mean, think about this. We've got China, we've got Russia invading Ukraine, but at the same time, we have China saber rattling about Taiwan. And I think people who are doing any reflection are reflecting on the fact that we have appeased Vladimir Putin more than once over the years. Most famously, I would suggest to you, in 2014, when he took Crimea, and the only thing we provided was moral support and humanitarian aid. I think that was the place perhaps to rally the allies. President Obama did not have the same outlook as President Biden. I think that we're actually fortunate that we have an internationalist in the White House at the moment, and that we do not have either of our last two presidents in the White House right now. And I'm maybe this is Pollyannish, but I think there's an opportunity here for Biden to step up for his own good, for the country's good, and for the world's good. When I say his own good, I mean political good, the country's good and the world's good, in terms of resurrecting and leading the Western alliance and taking the stand here as an important signal to China and other adversaries around the world that yes, we do mean business, and yes, we are committed and will defend the liberal order.
So I usually save, as you know, the Pollyanna question for the end of the program, but we got it in early today. And I do have a few more questions. You mentioned gerrymandering. Can you talk to us a little bit about the role of gerrymandering in increasing partisanship, dividing people with more lines?
Sure. So, presuming that people have a general sense of what gerrymandering is, it simply means the drawing of congressional districts in the aftermath of a centennial census. And the more you gerrymander, what that means is the more you write districts so that there are either a propensity of Democratic voters in it or a propensity of Republican voters, as opposed to a mix of both. So you're representing a district that's 80% Democratic, or you're representing a district that's 80% Republican. All else being equal, those folks, particularly with activist bases in either party, will be more inclined to want to see partisanship, to want to defend Democratic or Republican principles, then they will be people who sort of mingled together anyway in their districts and want to want to see bipartisan achievement. The more of those people that come to Washington, the less inclined they're going to be to vote for bipartisan legislation. In a sense, it's surprising that we have as much bipartisanship as we do. And also, I will say one more thing is going on to add to the gerrymandering problem, which is that people are separating themselves by party, and they're literally moving to be in either redder or bluer states or districts. So it's a mutually reinforcing phenomenon that is reinforced by cable TV on one side or the other, print media on one side or the other, social media. So it's a growing challenge when it comes to trying to build bipartisan support on any challenge.
Does that also tend to eliminate the possibility of third-party candidates? If you create districts that are so determinedly one thing or another, does that rule out the third-party guys?
Yeah, it does. But another thing that makes it very difficult to create a third party are party election rules. And I am not an expert on this, but I do know that it is just under election law difficult for a third party to get created and become viable in a national way. I don't know as much as I should about the rules, but yes, absolutely. Gerrymandering is a challenge. Having said that, if you believe, as I do, that there is a moderate 60% of America waiting to be seized, if the rules allowed for it, I think a third party with common sense approaches to challenges at home and abroad would actually do quite well.
Maybe. It's another hopeful thought, right?
Right.
So you took us back to a part of our history where it was frequently said, and I think it was believed more or less, that politics stopped at the water's edge, that you could have big debates at home about domestic issues, but you were supposed to present a united front. And we did, and in a lot of cases we did. Was that partly because for a lot of those years, Democrats were the majority party in Congress and Republicans the minority, and they were supposed to be the loyal opposition? There wasn't necessarily a lot of switching back and forth. Did that help to create a unified foreign policy, even if it was based on a majority party?
Oh, I don't know about that, frankly. I'm just not sure. When, you know, in a sense, Shoshana, it was Arthur Vandenberg, first of all, who said politics should stop at the water's edge. So this goes back to the late 40s. You know, another way to look at this is it was a golden moment, and while we can see it again, and we have seen it, you know, after 9/11 and, you know, after, you know, other incidents of real national challenge, it's also the case that it is honored in the breach. The debates over Vietnam got pretty tough, you know, by 1965, 66, certainly. After Johnson greatly militarized the war, it was Democrats who were leading the fight to challenge him. The bipartisanship certainly after 9/11 certainly extended through the Patriot Act, but then pretty soon after Afghanistan, we were fighting bitterly over Iraq because it was very controversial. We even fought quite vigorously over the Persian Gulf War of 1991 when the issue was, you know, I think less controversial and perhaps, you know, crisper, sharper, starker, just in terms of right and wrong and what should be our next step. Obviously, 9/11 was an issue of right and wrong, but in terms of what should be our next step, I think it was more clear cut with regard to 1991. So I don't know that I would say that the fact that Democrats basically ran things for most of that period is the reason for bipartisanship. And I also don't know how much lasting bipartisanship we had, other than on the principal issue of the Cold War consensus, and that our biggest challenge was Soviet expansionism. We certainly had a continuum of consensus on that for, you know, throughout the Cold War.
You raised an interesting analogy. The Persian Gulf War was Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait, and It didn't take us very long to figure out that Kuwait needed to be defended, and we went and defended it. And, you know, I think most people were pretty okay with that. Mm-hmm. So now you have Russia invading Ukraine, which we believe is an independent country. The sympathy is all with Ukraine, but not a whole lot of people are planning to go and defend Ukraine. And I'm just not sure why. And it's, I'm not sure if that's a question or a comment, but you raise an interesting point. In 1990, very few people, I think, objected to rescuing Kuwait, whereas right now, people would object if we went to Ukraine to rescue Ukraine from Russia. Could have something to do, I suppose, with the size of the opposition. Fighting Saddam Hussein was different than fighting Vladimir Putin and the Russians.
Yeah, so let me say two quick things. First of all, look, you can't get away from the fact that you know, we've got a nuclear Russia, and we've got a person in Moscow who, you know, there are more and more questions about his state of mind and all the rest. And so that's one thing. And, you know, we just should be upfront about it. I mean, it's just a different animal. But number two, look, who shapes public opinion more than any single individual in the country? Even if they're at less than 50% in the polls, the president. The president said early on, we are not putting boots on the ground. It is not surprising to me that there isn't much support for putting boots on the ground. No one is making the case for it. I'm not saying that it would be popular if they made the case for it, but I that is a very big difference from 1991. So you can't lose sight of the fact, I mean, I don't think when it comes to foreign policy that really consensus grows at the grassroots and then moves up to leadership. I think it's just the opposite. I mean, James Baker, the former Secretary of State, said quite famously, foreign policy is like the plumbing. Nobody thinks about it until there's a leak. And I think there's a lot to that. So if the president made the case, if the case was made, more so in a bipartisan manner, we might see some support. I don't know.
Good thought. And one last question.
Yep.
Based on the fact that we've just discussed the war in Kuwait and the war in Ukraine and all the other potential wars, we have a lot more military experience in Congress now than we have had since the early days. Is it possible that a larger number of veterans who have different ways of approaching problems than civilians do could increase bipartisan cooperation on the Hill?
That is possible, but I also have to tell you that it's not the case that having more veterans on the Hill will necessarily lead to a consensus over a more robust foreign policy. You know, I have great respect for veterans. But I do find that they have a diversity of views, just like the rest of us do. And some veterans, like Jack Kennedy, for instance, come away from war with a determination that we not have another one because they have seen the horrors of war. So I would expect that, you know, there'd be an appreciation, a greater appreciation for our military, absolutely, with more veterans. But a more of a consensus about what we should do overseas, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure.
Okay, so that is not the usual upbeat, positive note upon which—
I'm sorry.
I know you're sorry. I'm sorry too. That's okay, because this has been a really, really enlightening webinar. I think we have been able to focus on different things here than we normally do. We usually look at the Iranian government and what it does and the Chinese government and what it's occasionally, it's a good idea to look at our own government and think about what it does and how it does it. So I want to thank you for a fascinating webinar, a great way to spend our lunch hour. And I think with things that we take away from here and we will use as we go forward. So Larry Haas, thank you.
Well, everybody, thank you. I'll leave you with an uplifting note. I see that you've got Eli Lake next week. He's really good, and he may have an interesting take on American foreign policy that'll add to what I say.
So that's what I was going to say. I was going to say to our listeners, thank you for joining us today. We have two next week, and Eli Lake is fabulous. He is on Tuesday, but we also have Eli Kohanim on Thursday, And for those of you who have heard her, Ellie is the former special envoy for countering anti-Semitism. She's also Iranian born and has great connections inside Iran to Iranian people. So we're going to learn a lot next week. Eli Lake from Bloomberg News is fantastic. Ellie Kohanim is really fantastic. You will get your invitations from us. Tell everybody you know. Join us next week. But it probably won't be better than this. So Larry, thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks, everybody.